Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Into the 9 o'clock hour, Astro fans be listening next segment. Ben Ryder, author of Astro Ball, is going to join us. He was the one who predicted the Astros winning the World Series in 2017, 3 years ahead of time.
Yeah, and everybody Sports thought, oh, there goes Sports Illustrated, just trying to get some clickbait.
Look at like, you, nope. Your cover porn.
Yeah.
George Springer hitting a dinger.
Does he work for Sports Illustrated?
Who, Ben Ryder?
Yeah.
I don't know if he still does. He still does? Okay, good.
He does? Okay.
So that's probably a good thing that you asked that.
Sports Illustrated just fired like half their editorial staff.
They did.
They've had to make cuts. People get mad at the publications themselves, and I don't understand why. It's just a sign of the times. They can't make money anymore.
Yeah.
They're
not charities.
The same people who aren't buying the magazine anymore will act like Sports Illustrated is doing people wrong.
How could you do that,
by trying
guy like
to make
that?
Money. How could you actually still try to exist as a business entity instead of just going bankrupt?
You've got some nerve.
It's just the way things are these days.
It is, unfortunately. So the Texans lose to the Colts this past weekend, and one of the big things about the Texans beating the Chiefs was that the Colts had beat the Chiefs the week before. That was unexpected when the Colts did it. They were double-digit underdogs in that game in Kansas City. So when they beat the Chiefs, I'm thinking, wow, the Texans need to match this because, these two teams, I think, are going to be going kind of neck and neck this season.
Yeah.
Now, the Colts are better than people thought they would be. They're a pretty good football team. The big problem for the Texans with losing to the Colts and what makes the Week 12 game where they play them on Thursday night so crucial is obviously you don't want to get swept by your division foe. But the other reason why it's so crucial is the way the NFL does the schedule, Seth.
The teams in the division all have the same. They all have the same opponents except for two.
There's two
non-common opponents. And it's a particularly drastic difference between the opponents this year.
That's exactly right. The two variable games on the schedule for the Texans and the Colts, they cross over with the teams in the AFC East and the AFC North that finished in the same spot in the standings with them in 2018, the correlating teams in 2018. So the Texans were division champs. Who do they get? They get the Patriots at home. The Patriots, who have the highest point differential through seven games of any team in the post-leather helmet era right now, is what I'll say. The other game, the Texans are matched up with last season's AFC North champion. That would be the Baltimore Ravens, who are pretty damn good this year and pretty explosive offensively. That game is in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
The two corresponding games for the Colts, whereas the Texans play the Patriots and the Ravens, two teams that were good last year and are in line to win their divisions again this year, the Colts catch the Steelers, who don't have Ben Roethlisberger anymore, and Mason Rudolph got knocked out. They were playing with a third-string quarterback a couple weeks ago, and the Miami Dolphins,
yeah,
who might be what they are the exact antithesis of what the Patriots are. The Dolphins might be the worst team that we've seen in the last 20 or 25 years, whereas the Patriots might be the best. So it's almost like there's a built-in at least one game and maybe even two game advantage, depending on how the Texans do in those two games.
You've got to, and this is where I felt, leaving that Colts game, it was weird. I've been trying to psychoanalyze myself about how I responded to that Colts game. It's not like I was angry. It's not like I was upset. And I know one of our listeners and I have been kind of going back and forth about the Bill O'Brien burning a timeout to take the safety deal and all that. I'm not even upset about that. You could make good cases on either side of whether that was a horrible clock management deal or not. Our one listener is basically making a case that it wasn't a horrible clock management. That's fine. I kept waiting for the anger to come about that loss. And I think at least part of it is that I can look at that game and say, well, so much of it were simply self-imposed mistakes. What's the word?
Self-inflicted.
It's self-inflicted wounds. So much of it were correctable mistakes that I say it wasn't like they were so extremely outplayed that they just got their asses beat by the Indianapolis Colts.
Yeah.
And I think part of it too is just that. I think part of it is that the Astros. I'm too distracted by the Astros at this point.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about that. That I need to be more concerned about the Texans right now. But I've got so much of my damn energy wrapped up in the Astros that I'm just kind of hoping that the Texans can tread water until it's time for me to come back and really pay attention this next weekend.
It's like you've got one. It's like you got two kids, and one kid is the star athlete.
Yeah.
Who is the All-American boy, and he's the greatest thing ever. And your other kid is in detention all the time. And whereas you should probably be spending more time focusing on the kid who is in and out of detention,
yeah.
You like going to the games of your All-American son because he's dominating out there.
You know, one of the most depressing studies I've seen lately
was Tell that us.
Less attractive babies get held less by their parents. And that's
Where
what it feels like
this
right
stuff?
Now. This is like in the mainstream media, baby. These are the things that make the headlines. Of course
that's
they
true.
Make the headlines.
What am I saying?
It's not like I'm like digging through medical journals.
I'm acting like I'm not on Facebook. Like it's all there is on Facebook. Ugly babies.
Yeah. And this was, but this was a real story.
Yeah.
And like right now, the Texans feel a little bit like my less attractive baby. If I had fraternal twins and one was better looking than the other, I'd be like, sorry. Sorry, pork chops. I'm hugging the pretty one.
Sorry. I'm going to hug my pretty fraternal twin, Jose.
So whatever degrading nickname you give your other child.
That's right. That's right. Oh, it's funny.
Dump truck.
I'm looking. Pork chop. I love that. That pork chop's a great name.
Sorry, gargoyle. I'm hanging out with the winner.
All right. If I look confused right now, Seth, it's because... And I apologize. I hate doing this mid-segment. We just got done talking about the schedule for the Texans and the Colts. The XFL sent out its schedule for the season.
Oh, hell yeah.
So
we'll plan my spring, baby.
Well, the Houston Roughnecks, obviously, one of the eight teams. And so I opened it. And
Roughnecks is actually the name for my third least attractive baby.
Appropriately named.
That's not even a nickname. Just named him Roughneck. You're going to have a rough go of it in life, son. I'm preparing for you right
either
now.
Either that or you're going to be the toughest kid on the playground.
If you want to make it in this world, you got to be tough. I'm either going to name you Sue or Roughneck. Go ahead and take your choice.
Take your choice. Yeah. So I'm looking at the schedule. I was excited to open the schedule just because I want to see, hey, who do the Houston Roughnecks play each week? You know, there's certain... You know, games, is there going to be a rivalry with the Dallas team? Who knows? I think there's a Dallas team, right, in the XFL?
Yeah. Bad. So, I've hated them forever.
So the XFL sent out its schedule, and I'm pointing this to you right now.
You need to decipher it for you?
Well, no, I don't think it's going to work.
Well, yeah, sure, of course it is, because the way the schedule's laid out, what I can tell is that in week one, the Roughnecks, I know the Roughnecks are the Oil Derrick, right?
Right.
So the Oil Derrick, they're playing L.A., so they're playing a team in L.A.
Okay.
You go to week two, and the Roughnecks are going to be playing, I don't know, a team that looks like it might be, is that a flying bird of some sort?
I think like a wing thingy, or maybe a Richie Valens flying guitar.
And then, of course, because there's no name here.
Right.
There's no city. Oh, wait, no, there is, right there. It's St. Louis.
Oh, okay, there it is. Okay, yeah. Thank God.
I don't know
God.
What their name is, though. It's
I don't
Louis,
either.
The
okay,
Louis
but it's a very small font.
St. Louis, wow, guard your computers, Roughnecks. There's some dastardly types in that city.
That's right. Do you think the St. Louis XFL team has the passwords for
Probably.
The Houston XFL teams?
So you can't trust them as Jordan.
What do you think June Jones's password is for his
June Jones something Hawaiian
Luau.
Something yeah.
I can't. Mahalo.
Can we lobby the Roughnecks to have June Jones coach in a Hawaiian shirt?
I bet he does, not
with SMU. Has he really?
Here's why I bet he does for the XFL.
Oh, okay.
Is because he's shown up in a Hawaiian shirt at every XFL function so far.
Oh, all
They're
right.
embracing that as sort of his persona, I think.
Okay.
There was
gotcha.
A lot of Hawaiian flavor at their introduction for him.
Yeah, it would have been weird at SMU.
Yeah.
Especially with the whole Mustangs thing and everything. You know, nobody wants to picture a guy in a Hawaiian shirt on a horse.
That would have
been strange. Unless he's on the beach, you know.
Yeah, right.
Like they paid $45 for the ride, riding the horse.
Exactly.
The took my honeymoon with my wife to Hawaii, and we wanted to go horse riding on the beach, but I was too fat, so we couldn't do it.
Well, yeah.
Weight limit was like 225 or something absurd.
Okay, well, you're never going to be 225.
Right, exactly.
I mean, unless something horrible happens to you, you're never going to be 225 pounds. When did you get married and go on your honeymoon? What year were you in the NFL at that point?
It would have been, I guess, year five in the NFL.
Yeah. Okay, so back at the back end of your Jacksonville portion of your career.
We're living on a...
So you're probably at peak weight at that point.
Oh, right? I was the nose guard in a 3-4, you know? And it was also... We stayed in Kauai, and it was on this... It was, like, one of the last legal nude beaches in Hawaii, which we didn't know. It's not like I was like, hey, I'm going to marry my wife and then let her know that I'm a swinger on the honeymoon. Like, it wasn't that. But you go... Because you go and you find out this... Oh, it's a nude beach, which is never the glamour that you think it's going to be. Because we got down there, it was this... I want to call them homeless people, but they're people that chose to live on the beach that live naked and definitely don't shave much. And it was...
You saw these people?
It was kind of scary, if anything, yeah. Felt like I was in a Land Before Time.
Which island was this?
Kauai. Kauai's a very hippie-ish kind of island, yeah.
Yeah, so Kauai's a granola crunchy island.
Yeah. It wasn't like it was a crowded, like, super resort-type beach or anything, but it was kind of freaky because there were people, like... Because we were staying in this little cabin we had rented, and it was also next to a bunch of people that were choosing to live, you know, naked on the beach.
Did you stay and watch? Did you guys go naked?
No. Okay. It was cool, and they weren't judgmental. It's not like the naked hippies were like, oh, why you got your clothes on? I didn't know I was going to be harassed by the man while I was down
there. And you
didn't
sit there and critique them either. You were like Simon Cowell.
I mean, you could have braided their pubic hair. That's how unkempt they were. I offered. I acted like I was a beach urchin. Right. I was like, oh, $5 and I'll braid your pubic hair.
You had a table set up with a little draped curtain there that had a price on it.
Braid it and put some beads in it and
tarot
everything.
Tarot cards and pubic hair braiding. Yeah. That's good stuff. So anyways,
how many games do they play?
They play 10 games. They open at home against LA.
Uh-huh.
But then the following week, they have two games at home to open the season.
Okay.
But then they go on the road to Tampa Bay.
Okay.
And then to Dallas. Boy, that Dallas game, that's going to be really... That Tampa Bay game, I'm going to fade the Roughnecks, I think, and bet against them because they're going to be looking ahead to Dallas in week four. I'm already planning my betting strategy with the Houston Roughnecks.
It might be like an NFL game, though, too, where the Dallas team doesn't even have a home field advantage because Houston travels up there. It's a shorter trip from the Woodlands.
Yeah.
And you travel up there and you just create your own home field advantage.
That's right. That's what we're going to do. That's what we the Roughnecks are going to do. There's going to be money to be made on this league, I'm telling you right now, from a gambling perspective. I got to find the holes.
Antonio Brown, would he be a candidate? I guess they probably wouldn't have Antonio Brown in the... I wonder if he would consider it if the price was right.
The XFL?
Yeah.
I doubt it.
He's making a hardcore push to try to get back into the fold. I guess, are there text
messages
now?
You've been
at
the school of thought. You are on the record saying you think he's going to play for a team this year.
I think.
How are you feeling about that right now, Shecky?
There are reports that teams are keeping an eye on him. The fear is this. There are rumors that there are other stories waiting in the wings. And I think a lot of teams fear that there might be people that are just waiting to release these stories when he gets signed by another team.
Yep.
So if somebody signs him, there's not going to be any guaranteed money. And then apparently there are text messages to Mark Davis, too, that say, hey, I want off this team. So Antonio Brown's trying to claim that he deserves his guaranteed money, but there
what
might be
dumbass
text evidence, which should surprise nobody.
No, zero. Zero.
The only thing he might have going for him is if his text messages are impossible to understand. He might
distinct
be able to get up in court and be like, well, you can't prove that text message says I want to be
That's
out.
That's true. If you don't put punctuation in text, you can construe them many different ways.
Yeah.
Game one, World Series tonight, Garrett Cole, Max Scherzer. Very excited about that. Around town. Man, the second World Series in 3 years here in Houston. Joining us right now, great book, Astro Ball, The New Way to Win It All. This guy, back in 2014, predicted that the Astros would win a World Series in 2017. He was right. He writes for a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. And he joins us right now. He wrote the book Astro Ball. Ben Ryder joining us on Payne and Pendergast here on Sports Radio 610. Ben, it's great to have you on the show. It's a great book, a great read, and certainly a book that's going to pop back up into the conscious of Astro fans as we run through this postseason run. You had unprecedented access to the team in doing this. From Jeff Luhnow arriving in 2011 and in looking at Luhnow's history here as GM, all the facets that go into it, is there any part of the GM function that surprises you that Jeff Luhnow has been real, real good at?
You know, I think that he's always painted as a numbers nerd. You know, a guy who will hew to the numbers, will stick to the numbers no matter what. What's always surprised me has been his ability to understand what the numbers, what the analytics aren't describing. You know, factors like team chemistry, like paying to bring in Carlos Beltran in 2017. There's a chapter in Astroball about the incredible impact he had in the clubhouse that maybe you wouldn't see just by watching the games. And also, frankly, just his ability or willingness to make a call, you know, make a human call here or there, acquiring Justin Verlander at the deadline in 2017 with 2 seconds to go, again, acquiring Zach Greinke here. Like, those were real in-the-moment calls made by Jeff Luhnow. He's more than a guy who just does whatever computers say. He's got his own baseball intuition and his own gut as well, and sometimes he'll act on it.
If you look at this team in 2017, a lot of things they were doing, you know, as it happens in sports, other teams have copied what the Astros are doing, and you're starting to see it maybe on the pitching side of things. Where have the Astros maybe lost a little bit of an advantage because other teams are using a lot of their methods and techniques?
Well, I think they've lost a little bit of advantage as far as kind of talent ID, you know, using their analytics, using their processes to turn up inefficiencies as far as picking the right players in the drafts, analyzing free agents and stuff like that. You know, when they started, not every team even had an analytics department at all. You know, now that's no longer true. It's almost table stakes. You have to have a strong analytics department to even have a chance of competing. But what the Astros have done really well is to continue to innovate on top of their basic philosophy. A lot of the stuff they're doing now relates to player training, no longer to talent ID, but to performance enhancement, allowing players to get the very best out of their abilities. And we've certainly seen that time and again, especially with the pitchers. Justin Verlander comes over, pitches as well as he ever has. Gerrit Cole comes over, pitches much, much better than he ever has. That's really where the Astros have still maintained a significant advantage over much of baseball.
Ben Ryder, author of Astro Ball, joining us on Sports Radio 610. I'm glad you're touching on all those things, Ben, because my question is this. When fans in cities where teams are quote-unquote tanking, when they point to, I guess, sort of the prime example of quote-unquote tanking working, it's the Houston Astros. As someone who watched that whole process unfold, both with the access that you had and the way it's unfolded since they've risen back into prominence, do you cringe a little bit when people just sort of reduce it to, well, the Astros got terrible and then picked a bunch of good players?
I do cringe a little bit. I mean, look, it's not inaccurate. They certainly weren't trying necessarily or doing everything they could to win in those early years. I think there's a difference between the Astros and a lot of other organizations that are trying to do this now, is that you have to remember, taking you back to like 2011, 2012, they had absolutely nothing to work with. It's not like they had many assets at the major league level. They had the worst minor league system in baseball, a couple pieces in there. You know, George Springer was around, Altuve was around, but by and large, the worst minor league system. Like, they didn't have anything to trade, right? Like, this was, the cupboard was bare. This was, in many ways, the only logical step for them. I'm not sure that a lot of other teams that do have maybe some pieces that they could work with have as much reason to follow this path, especially now that so many teams are doing it. You know, when you're the team that's taking this revolutionary route and you're really all alone, it's one thing. But when there's 7-8 teams in the league trying to do the same thing, the chances of succeeding at it are significantly minimal.
Ben, you obviously are around. You hear a lot of the scuttlebutt. And when we're listening to A-Rod talk on and on and on again about sign stealing and tipping pitches with the Astros, do you get a sense that the Astros are singled out as a team that's accused of cheating more? Or is it just a problem in baseball right now with sign stealing?
I think they're singled out because of their success. That doesn't mean that they're not trying to do it. I think there's certainly a line that can be crossed. I don't know if the Astros have or not, to be quite honest. You know, I feel like using things like hidden video cameras and stuff would not be considered within the normal bounds of gamesmanship. But look, sign stealing has been part of baseball for time immemorial. Every team does it. You know, the whistling whistlegate at Yankee Stadium never made any sense whatsoever, as if a batter in the box during a playoff game at Yankee Stadium could hear somebody whistling from the dugout. That story never made much sense. So it does make you think that, yes, perhaps there are some people out there who, for reasons of jealousy or competition or whatever, are maybe focusing on the Astros a little too much when it comes to this stuff.
I felt like maybe if you're going to make allegations about whistling, it could have made sense if you're playing the Rays and there's only 10,000 people in the stands. But when
right.
You got 50,000 people in the stands at Yankee Stadium, I don't see how you could differentiate a whistle from another whistle. So, yeah, I didn't quite get that. The other thing that I didn't realize either, Verlander was talking about the other day, was how many measures baseball has taken to monitor what the teams in the dugouts and in the video room are monitoring. That it would be really, and that the penalties for sign stealing are pretty damn severe if they do find you using electronic devices.
Right. No, they've certainly put in some rules and regulations in place to fight against this. But look, again, I don't think anybody in baseball really thinks there's anything wrong in doing it the old-fashioned way.
Right.
Kind of like I read about in Astro Ball that Carlos Beltran did in 2017 with the Dodgers, you know, just studying videotape of Yu Darvish. He saw that he was tipping his pitches. He was tipping his off-speed pitches, tipping his fastball. That was a big reason why the Astros lit him up in Game 3 and Game 7. And that's perfectly okay. You know, if you don't want somebody to pick up on that, then you shouldn't be tipping your pitches.
Ben Ryder, author of Astro Ball, joining us on Sports Radio 610. So Ben, given what you know and have observed from Jeff Luhnow, Jim Crane obviously will have probably the major say in this. What does your instinct tell you about what's going to happen with Gerrit Cole this offseason in the Astros?
Look, I mean, the Astros always have a balance of the long-term and the short-term interests of their club. Their payroll has significantly skyrocketed since I began writing about them. They're right up against the luxury tax now. They love Gerrit Cole. Obviously, the relationship will probably end up making Gerrit Cole personally an extra $100 million+. I think that it is improbable that he'll be coming back to Houston just because he'll be so expensive. So many other teams will be after him, the Yankees, the Angels, the Dodgers, virtually any big spending team you can think of. I think that the great likelihood is that he's leaving, but it's not definite. Anything could happen. Perhaps he will value this relationship so much he'll want to stay. But I would suggest Astros fans enjoy him as much as they can for the one or two starts he'll be getting this week.
No doubt. Ben Ryder, author of Astro Ball, joining us here on Sports Radio 610. Always good to go back and read that book as the as it chronicles the building of this Astros. All we hope is a bit of an Astros dynasty, certainly at least a two-time champion. We hope that it is a week from now. Ben, we really appreciate it. Folks can get the book at all the normal places they get books, right?
Yep. Amazon, favorite online retailer, favorite independent bookshop, should be able to find it. And it does kind of explain a lot of the secrets to the Astros' success, not just in 2017, but how it's continued and how, in fact, the team has somehow gotten better and better since that championship season.
If I were you, I would set up an impromptu book signing and sell them outside of the home plate entrance tonight until security shoos you away.
Maybe I will.
We just finished up talking to Ben Ryder, the author of Astro Ball, and we asked him about tanking, and does he cringe a little bit when people seemingly attribute just the tanking itself to the Astros becoming good again? Alex Bregman was actually asked about the build of this Astros roster yesterday, and he kind of echoed what Ben Ryder said. He said they didn't build the roster the way a lot of people think.
Our formula is kind of a little bit different than what people think. A lot of people think that we just tanked for 3 years, but our organization kind of went out and signed some big pieces as well. It wasn't just it's not all build from within. It's build from within, but then add big pieces as well down along the way.
He's exactly right about that, Seth. And I think that's the thing that has surprised me with Jeff Luhnow, is that a guy whose reputation coming into this job was an analytics sort of guy, business consultant, before he got into the baseball world. He's a deal maker, man. Like, it's not just the numbers thing and crunching numbers and going and finding young players. He's a deal maker.
Well, but I guess the question is always going to be, yes, he is a deal maker, but nobody's going to deny that tanking was part of it. It's not as simple as just tanking.
That's what bothers me sometimes.
It bothers you when people say, well, of course they tanked. Because what we're going to discover over the next decade as tanking loses its stigma and teams are just going to flat out do it out in the wide open is that there's competition amongst other tankers. When you're not the only, like when multiple people are tanking, it's not as simple as, oh, we'll just tank and we'll get a bunch of all these. You're going to have to draft well. And then what do you do with those assets? But with all the deal making, yes, some of those deals could have been done without tanking. Some of them couldn't, because some of them involve prospects that you gained while you were tanking too. You're picking the first in each round, remember? It's part of it. Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of teams, and we're going to see this with various football teams, the Miami Dolphins. What do you do with all those assets after you get them? That's where you earn your money as a GM. And that's where I think whenever somebody says, "Well, you tanked," that's usually just an opposing fan that's trying to get a shot in you. I don't worry about it too much. If somebody says you tanked, I'm like, yeah, of course we did.
You know what I thought about? Not at all. As the ball was sailing over the left field wall late Saturday night off of Jose Altuve's bat, how the Astros were built and arrived at that moment.
Right.
I was not thinking about that in the moment.
And he's the perfect example of a guy that anybody could have had Jose Altuve.
That's right.
Anybody could have gotten him, signed him for $15,000 in a developmental camp.
And he was two regimes ago, by the way. Right. He wasn't even the Ed Wade regime. He was signed by the Tim Papura regime. I read a great story yesterday. Al Padrique, I think I'm pronouncing his name right, who used to be a scout for the Astros. He's been a manager in the big leagues, former player. He was part of the Jose Altuve discovery team, you know, the group of scouts and folks within the Astros organization that found him. He fudged Jose Altuve's height so that he wouldn't just get summarily dismissed by the higher-ups in the front office for the Astros. Like, he fudged his height by like an inch or two.
It's a scary thing about it. If you're in hiring, you always got to think about sometimes when people, because you're looking at 20,000 resumes and you just get rid of so many just based on very basic parameters, you know you're throwing out some diamonds in the rough there. And you can get away with it when you're at a big company and you're hiring that many people. But when you're in the business of sports or what have you, if you just summarily dismiss everybody that's shorter than 5'8", all of a sudden you never would have had a shot at a Jose Altuve. These teams that just comb the surface of every place in South and Central America, it pays off eventually.
It's the Jose Altuves of the world, Seth, that keep front offices and scouts in business. You know what I mean? Like, this guy is a guy that you had to scan every nook and cranny of Venezuela to go find the guy. And you identify him, you go, we think there's something here. Now, what you didn't know is that the guy was going to become a great power hitter, that he would become a really good second baseman, that he would become the greatest player in the history of the franchise.
Right.
Nobody knew that was going to be ultimately the ceiling for him. You just knew he had a chance to be a pretty good baseball player.
Imagine how many other potential Jose Altuves are out there. Like, because it's too freakish a coincidence that a guy who's 5'6", probably 5'5", is also one of the very best players in baseball. It means that there's other guys out there that it could be 5'5" and just average players in baseball that never were going to get that chance because you have to be so much better than everybody else.
Yeah,
you need to start a league for 5'8" and under, and then the guys that rise to the top of that league would be easier to figure out. Like, oh, okay, this guy's got a shot in Major League Baseball.
And then if there are guys who are shorter in Major League Baseball but they're not very good, they get relegated.
Oh, yeah,
to the short person.
So the short guys can beat up on these gargantuans that aren't earning their pee, aren't using all of their natural ability.
Right. I was on a station yesterday.
Like a Daryl Morey musical.
I was on a station in San Diego yesterday.
Yeah.
Our intercom brethren in San Diego, they had me on out there. And they're one of these teams that Ben Reiter was alluding to that's kind of trying to tank right now. Now, they're not doing a very good job when they're spending $300 million on Manny Machado. And that's what I told them. They asked me yesterday, like, for sort of a primer on what it's like to root for a tanking team. Like, what was it like in 2012 and 2013? And I'm like, it was kind of painful, except you just ignored. The Astros got more ignored than scorned. Like, if a team in a big market, not Houston's a big market, but if one of the blue blood teams that has a payroll, that has the resources, but they're just at a point where their minor league system is barren, where the thing to do is just sell off assets and do what the Astros did. If they did that in Boston or New York, there would probably... these are markets that obsess over every pitch of every game.
Mm-hmm.
The Astros just stayed off the radar, by and large, for most people for a few years, and then they became good again, and then everybody came back, and now everybody's singing Kumbaya, and the city loves the Astros. They're awesome. And I warned them. I said, it's not as simple as just sucking and drafting high. You need some luck. You need Brady Aiken's elbow to be a little wonky, and then you send him back into the pool and you draft Alex Bregman the next.
Before you draft him. In baseball, it's just, hey, good luck.
Yeah.
Draft these guys. So the Astros did something kind of unconventional, got a whole bunch of crap for it, and it ended up yielding Alex Bregman ultimately.
They got, yep, that's right. They got it since they didn't sign Aiken, they got a pick the following year, and they're using on Bregman.
That goes about that's it's not just tanking, it's a whole lot of other revolutionary stuff.
That's right. So you need a little bit of luck. Sometimes it's the moves that you don't make. You need to make some deals, Verlander, Cole, Greinke. You need an owner that's willing to spend at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
That Jim Crane knew when it was 2013 and 2014, we're not going to go spending $20 million a year on guys now. But they did start to, when 2015 came around, they did start to spend. You know, they went and they, within the next couple of years, signed Josh Reddick and trade for Brian McCann. They signed Carlos Beltran. They knew when the right time was to start signing the right level of pieces.
Right. Well, even the moves like Yuli Gurriel. And there's something, too, as Cuban players became more widely available, it's harder to scout Cuban players, or at least it was because there wasn't as much information on them at the right time. And so you have a guy like Luno that looks at something like that and sees opportunity.
Yep.
And like, I don't think it's any surprise that so many Cuban players found their way to the Astros roster, because I think Luno probably looks at that as, hey, people don't really know what they're doing when they're scouting Cuban players because it's a whole different world in the league they played in and everything. I think Luno probably felt like an advantage there. That's more than just tanking. That's just simple free agency moves.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. They were shocked. The San Diego guys were shocked when I said, I don't think Gerrit Cole's going to be back with the team next year.
Oh, really?
They're like, you can't let Cole walk. I'm like, I know. You can't. I mean, trust me, I want him with this team.
Yeah.
But he's going to cost ton of money, man.
Let me ask you this, because at the time of the Greinke trade, somebody reached out to you on Twitter and said, hey, by the way, Sean, you know, they wouldn't have had to trade for Greinke if they had just kept Morton. And you crushed that person. And I think the mob at that point crushed him. As you get further away from the heat of the moment, and especially as Greinke struggles a little bit,
yeah,
it's hard to ignore that part of it. It's hard to ignore that, wow. One of the reasons you let go of Charlie Morton was because he was old. So you replace him with a guy who's even older in Zach Greinke and it doesn't have the injury history that Charlie Morton did. But there is that part of me that just every time Greinke has struggled in the playoffs, all I've thought is like, wow, you could have had Charlie Morton here and retained those prospects.
You could have. Now, if they don't make the Greinke trade, let's pretend for a second we don't even know that there were talks about Greinke. Are we talking about them? We probably are, actually, talking about them letting Charlie Morton walk, because Wade Miley still would have imploded. We may even be talking about it more, that they let Charlie Morton walk. Yeah, it's a fair point to bring up, I guess, that I crushed the guy. Look, I would still...
I crushed him too, because in the moment it felt like, all right, yeah, you know what? That's a mistake they may have made last year, but screw it. We're living in the now right now.
And it's the day after a huge deal. Like, it's just more of a celebratory mood. The Greinke thing concerns me more, quite honestly, about 2020 than now. Like, he's a perfect third starter for this team right now. He really is. Is he the perfect number two starter for a team that's trying to, you know, win 100-plus games again? We'll have to wait and see. I don't know. I don't know if I'm as confident in that. Landry Locker is here. I'm confident in him that he's going to have a good show today.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be great. Obviously, you know what's going on. You know why we're here. World Series getting started. We're going to get into that. J-Lo's got some nugs. We're going to talk to Spillane. We're also going to look into this Texans trade that they made. We're gonna get to know this Conley fella.
You got a bit of a look on your face. Are you thumbs up or thumbs down?
I mean, we're
gonna
get to know this Conley guy a little bit better. The bottom line is this: if you want to feel good about him, don't look at what he's done. Look at the fact that maybe a change of scenery will help him out. Because the bottom line is this: the Raiders, they're not rebuilding. They're actually supposed to be aggressive during the deadline, and they basically sent a limo to the airport with a cornerback in it that they're facing a team that they're competing with a playoff spot with in 6 days, and they sent him your way. So that tells you all you need to know about his Raiders career.
Okay.
So maybe he can be better here, but don't look at what he's done before.
Not to give away too much of what you're going to talk about, but does it feel to you like we're saying a lot of the same things about Conley that we were saying about Bradley Roby when they signed him?
I don't know, man. I think Bradley Roby might have had a little bit better body of work than
he had a longer body of work. He'd been around longer. Conley's only been around for 2 years and change.
He only played 2 games his rookie year. Last year, he got benched. It was a high-low, but he got benched. And this year, it was a very, very, very rocky start for him. So, I don't know.
I think Roby had some highs, at least.
Yeah.
And had done some really good things. It was a matter of his inconsistency. And you didn't spend future assets. Now it's... Each time this happens with a trade, I think I hear a lot of people say, well, look, this individual deal makes sense. And yes, it does. This individual deal makes sense. You start to look at the body of work of William O'Brien, the general manager, and I think around the league, teams probably get really excited when William O'Brien makes a call because they feel like, here's our high bidder.
It's like when they show up
we got a live one.
A cardboard check from Publishers Clearinghouse at your door.
The whole war room stops what they're doing. They come up around their GM. Mike Mayock was on the phone, and he's like reading from the script like in Boiler Room or from what was the other one with Leonardo DiCaprio? And everybody's just quiet, and they're just like freaking out.
Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street. Wolf of Wall Street.
Is it Wolf of Wall Street? Yeah.
So Mayock's in there, and he's like, look, Bill, look, I don't know. Maybe you got to check with your boss, Cal McNair, or something. Maybe you don't have the authority to do it on your own. But listen, Barry, you're playing with the big boys now. I need to talk to somebody that can make the deal. Can you make the deal, Bill O'Brien? And Bill's like, yeah, I can make the deal. I'm going to do it. I'll give you a third rounder. Let's do this. I feel really good about this.
This needs to be the tell for Bill O'Brien. I'm sorry, for William O'Brien, Esquire General Manager. This needs to be the tell that he's about to make a potentially bad deal is when the other GM goes, can I put you on speakerphone? And then it's still just that GM talking. Like there's no, usually you put somebody on speakerphone so other people can chime in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And O'Brien's like, yeah, you can put me on speakerphone. And it's still just Mayock talking. Like that should be the tell right there. Like, why did you put me on speakerphone? No reason.
Yeah.
No reason.
So Mayock's doing it just so people can listen.
Just so people can tune in and listen and see what a great deal he's about to make. Yeah. That Mayock's about to make.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. What do they need? I'm like you, man. Laissez-faire at this point. Laissez les bon temps rouler, baby.
We're just going with it, man.
That's it.
Landry, we're just like, hey, why fight anymore?
Seth and I are.
You know when you're in a car with a reckless driver and you're in high school and the peer pressure kids, if you're in high school, don't do what I did, which was, look, I'm a high school kid. The kid driving behind the wheel is a reckless driver, and you're like, well, I'm not going to be the P word. I'm going to enjoy it. All right, let's do it. Let's go, guys.
Yeah.
Let's go. No, I would advise all kids out there. First, you should be in school. Second, go ahead and just tell the guy to pull over and let yourself out.
Yeah, be responsible.
Be responsible.
Pull over. Don't trade that third round pick. So we're just drinking. Landry, that's what we're doing. We're drinking heavily. We're buckling up, and we're going for the O'Brien
ride,
baby.
We're riding in an 85 Malibu with no seatbelt and with a bunch of Malibu rum.
That's it. That's where Payne and Pendergast show stands on it, baby. All right. Are you guys going to be touching on this Brandon Taubman story as well?
Assistant GM. I mean, yeah, we're gonna touch on it. There's a lot of there's a lot of angles there to that. I'm not sure what exactly is supposed to be made of that, even if it did happen. Like, so it's a slippery slope. We'll touch on it. Okay. It won't like dominate the show or anything, but we'll get into it.
Okay, there you go. In the loop, Landry Locker, John Lopez. They will be with you starting here at the top of the hour, which will also coincidentally be the next time that you guys have a chance to win an opportunity to go to our Game 3 watch party up here on Friday on our big screen with fajita Pete's and Coors Light and a chance to win Justin Verlander commemorative baseball. It's going to be really, really cool. It's going to be a lot of fun. So be listening top of not just this hour, but every hour, all the way up to 6 p.m. and then 6 a.m., 6 p.m. tomorrow as well. We will be back here at 6 a.m. tomorrow. We'll be out there today. Clint Stoerner doing the show with Wade Smith and Jeremy Branham out across the street at Congress and Crawford across from Minute Maid Park. We'll all be hanging out there as well. Stop by, say hello, and we'll see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Go Stros.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.